Hi, folks. This is Jack Spirko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Today is Thursday, July the 24th, 2025, and this is episode 3710 of the Survival Podcast. Of course, it's an expert counsel Q&A show for the week since it is Thursday. This is going to be a good show. I got a really great lineup of experts for you. Before we tell you what's going to happen today, though, let me remind you, the Member Support Brigade is on sale right now. It's on sale basically till the end of next week. And what it does is it allows you to get the MSB for $35 a year instead of $50. Now, look, guys, $50 a year is a hell of a deal for MSB. If you just look at all the discounts you get, we have mushroom spawn, we have cannabis products, we have plants and seeds, and we have tactical, we have practical, and we have everything in between. I promise you, you are buying some of the things that you can get discounts on all the time if you listen to the show. You just wouldn't listen to the show if you weren't buying some of the stuff that we get you guys discounts on. And what that means is you can support this show at $35 a year, and you can get your money back. Most people will make a profit on MSB. With just a handful of the vendors, I would be making a profit if I paid for my own product. I use it all the time. It saves me a ton of money. It could save you a ton of money too. At $50 a year, it's a good deal. At $35 a year, it's a no-brainer. Please consider joining. We've been doing this show for 17 years. You want to keep us running for a bunch more years, then you want to get involved with the MSB. Again, $35, and all you got to do to get the special price is use discount code SUMMER. All lowercase, SUMMER. I figured that would make it easy. You'll get $35 a year, and when I say a year, I mean it will apply to your recurring membership. It will stay that cheap as long as you don't cancel your membership. And if something ever goes wrong, any of you that ever got a special price, if you didn't do it, if you didn't cancel, if a credit card failed, a bank turned down, you know, PayPal or Stripe screwed up or whatever, I'll always give you your discount back. Just ask for it, and I will take care of you. All right, with that, here's what we're going to talk about today. This is interesting. I never really thought about it this way. But, you know, it's come to our attention this week, probably as a distraction from Epstein, but it's a valid story nonetheless, that basically the Obama administration ran a coup against Donald Trump. I mean, there's no other word for it. But is it just a U.S. foreign policy tactic coming home? Is it just something we've done to countries all over the world for years and years and years, and then all of a sudden, well, why don't we just do it at home? I think so. That's what Dan McAdams and Dr. Ron Paul will talk about today. Matt Sersley will talk about a tax, a good thing with taxes, I guess, in the big, beautiful bill. It's not something I've talked a lot about because I think it's more hype than reality. No tax on overtime. And what Matt's answering a question for about today is, well, if you run your own company, can you work overtime, pay yourself overtime, and not pay taxes on it? Not really. It's probably not going to work out that way for you. It's probably a bad idea, and it probably won't save you as much money as you think it will. In fact, the whole no tax on overtime probably won't save most people as much as they think it's going to save them, because it's not what you think it is. It's not what you think it is. It's only on the overtime portion of your pay. Yeah, but that means even less than you think it is. It probably means 66% less than you think it is. Matt will explain it to you, but I'm going to tell you about something. You need to make sure, if you run a pass-through income entity like an LLC or something like that, you need to make sure that your accountant is factoring into your taxes, because I bet some of them ain't. It was made permanent and even a little bit better in the big, beautiful bill. Then Ryan Steva will talk about what critical load solar is and why it matters. He also has some really great resources for you guys today for doing your own solar projects. Then we have Andy McCann, who will talk about electrolytes for heavy workouts and what you should use, and what I'm going to call roll your own electrolytes. People way overpay for these electrolyte products. I mean, it's ridiculous. And anybody can roll their own, and it's actually really easy to do. Andy will talk about that. Mike Melito will talk about some books on hunting and guns and combat. And I sometimes screen the expert panel before I do the show and put it together, and I sort of kind of did that with this one. I didn't listen to the whole thing. He definitely mentions one of my favorite authors in this, but maybe I'll expand on it once I hear the full list and give you some other thoughts. And then we got Carrie Brown talking about foraging a plant called primrose. And then I'm going to answer a question that I feel like I've answered before, but not recently, on developing a website. Specifically a website, in this case, to sell tree seedlings. Because somebody tested the waters with Etsy and sold some tree seedlings and realized how bad the fees are over on Etsy. And I even have some thoughts on that for the individual as well. But I'm going to tell you why, if you're building a website in 2025, unless you have a very, very specific reason why this would not be the right answer, like you need to custom develop something or something like that, and you know what you're doing, if you're not using WordPress, you're just wrong. You're just wrong. And I'm sorry, like the site builders like Wix and the GoDaddy builder, and I'll just don't. And I'll explain why when I get to it. With that, before we hear from Dr. Paul and Dan McAdams on the domestic coup d'etat, let me remind you, one of the ways you can help support this show, other than being an MSB member, and it's on sale, right? It's on sale. Summer, the discount code. You can also do your online shopping at tspaz.com, T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. You know, I have items of the day that I recommend, and I usually have, you know, somewhere between 2 and 4 a week of items that I recommend. I have one for you today, but no matter what you buy, you'll help us out if you're going to shop online, if you just go to tspaz.com first. It's that simple. It doesn't cost you any extra money. It only takes a couple extra seconds. You help support the show. But I brought you some pretty cool items this week, including the 6-inch semi-stiff boning knife from Victorinox, the Oleta stainless steel olive bottle, which you got to get one of those if you're like me. I mean, oil makes you have slippery fingers. We all knock stuff over in the kitchen. I went through 3 beautiful ceramic olive oil dispenser bottles, and after the 3rd one broke, and I'm pretty sure I broke 2 and somebody else broke 1, I was at the end of this shit, and I got the stainless steel one from Oleta. It is awesome. I've given them as gifts, but today I got something for you that is great for your kitchen. Every prepper should have 1 or 2, and if you have 1 already, you might want to get 2 today. The Insta AccuSlim Sous Vide Precision Cooker. I don't care which one you get. They're all pretty damn good. They're probably all made in the same place. But the Insta AccuSlim is on sale today. I have it out as a deal of the day alert. It's on sale for $80. This thing normally retails for like $130, $129.99. And it's on 38% off at $80. I've been talking about getting a second one of these because my kind of jerry-rigged one that was like 8 years old from Anova finally shit the bed completely on me, and now I'm down to only one of these. I bought another one today. Sometimes it's just good to have 2. You can do 2 different things at the same time. Or, check this out, if you're doing like a mass amount of food, you can run 2, set it at the same temperature. Like in a cooler, it actually works really, really well. Like, I don't know if you're sous-viding like, you know, 4 whole pork loins, not tenderloins, loins, you know, cut in half and rubbed in, like that I do for the workshop, right? That's one way you can use them. I've also started using sous vide circulators. I need to amend this article because I give all these uses beyond like making a steak or something like that, including things like egg bites, boiled eggs, creme brulees, how you can use them to prep steak in advance, defrosting, how you can use it to make cheese, how you can use it to make yogurt. I got another one. Sterilizing mushroom spawn for mushroom cultivation. Now, the professional mushroom people will tell you what. Oh, you got to use 170 degrees at, you know, 14, 15 pounds, whatever it is, of pressure for 45 minutes or whatever. It's like, now, look, guys, I did some math on this. And if you're growing aggressive stuff, which is what most home growers do, like oysters and stuff like that, what you do is you take all your spawn mix and you put it in a vacuum seal bag and you vacuum seal it. Yes, I know the mushrooms can't survive that way. Hold on, right? So you throw it in your chamber vac or whatever, you vacuum seal it. You make as many bags as you want. You take your cooler and you throw all the bags in there and you fill it up with water. And you stick your sous vide circulator in, you set it on like 180 degrees. And you let it run for like 8 hours. Nothing's going to live in there. Then you have a sealed, sanitized medium. I'm telling you, nothing's going to grow in there. When you're ready to inoculate it, you cut the top of the bag off. Okay? Yeah, very simple. you drop your inoculation spawn in and mix it up. You seal the bag and you put a hole in it and put a piece of the first aid tape, the micro mesh first aid tape, over the hole. And then that way you have basically a filter. Or you can buy the actual filter patches and do that as well. But, guys, it works. It doesn't matter how long it takes. You're not sitting there watching it. You just, like, put them in the morning and come home from work and they're done. And then they're just shelf-stable as far as I'm concerned. I haven't had any of them show any signs of anything growing them after that treatment. And I just leave them vacuum sealed at that point until it's time to introduce the mycelium. Anyway, just like an added bonus if you're getting into mushrooms that you can take. This is my thing with stuff, right? I have a lot of stuff, and I like stuff, and I like the fact that we can get stuff. But I also don't like stuff that does one thing. I like to figure out how to function stack, and that's just another example of function stacking there. So with that, let's hear about a domestic coup d'etat, because I think that's exactly what this is. Make no mistake about it, I think it's being released at this time as a distraction from something else, but it doesn't make it any less real. Now, the question is, will anything actually be done about it? I remain eternally skeptical about that.
Well, the main thing we wanted to cover today is not easy to cover, and we both have sort of been wrestling with this for the past few days, because on the one hand, it's a blockbuster release. We're actually seeing the documents. We're actually seeing declassified documents demonstrating that a coup took place, or an attempted coup took place, after the 2016 elections. Not the fake January 6th insurrection, but an actual coup took place. Now, we spent years on this show talking about how phony Russiagate was, but the fact that Tulsi Gabbard, the Director of National Intelligence, came out and literally declassified those and said, look, this is what happened.
But when you take the principle of manipulating elections, I guess you could write a book about how many there have been, our involvement.
You make a great point there that's so important, because you're talking about all the times the U.S. manipulated elections overseas, hundreds of times. If I can go back to my past, as an election observer, I watched several of these color revolutions take place on the ground when I was physically there. And the group that I was with at the time, we kept saying to ourselves, you know, today the U.S. can be doing this overseas. Someday it's going to come to our shores. And that's exactly what happened with Obama. All of the overthrows, all of the Arab Springs, all the color revolutions that they were doing overseas, Obama must have sat down and said, why don't we just do that here? But there were so many victims, including, remember, General Mike Flynn. In the early days of the presidency, they wanted to disorient. They wanted to sow chaos. I mean, Clapper and Obama and his gang. They wanted to sow chaos, and so they got rid of Flynn on fake charges because there was no Russia collusion. And actually, Flynn, if we put that next one up, Flynn did comment on this, and he, if anyone deserves a comment, he deserves a comment about this, and he does a pretty good job. I probably messed you up. It's Flynn's post. There we go. Thank you. So Flynn said, with regards to the release by Tulsi Gabbard, this is surreal. Here in America, the Director of National Intelligence is now stating emphatically that a former president of the United States, Barack Obama, attempted a coup against Donald Trump. That is why Gabbard was attacked so relentlessly over the past few weeks and months. They knew if there were anyone with the guts to investigate the attempted coup, it would be her. Well done, and more to come. Checkmate. Very, very important. And I think it would be safe to say that the Ukraine war would not have happened if they had not done this coup, if Obama and Brennan and the rest, because they poisoned the well with regard to Russia. We could not have good relations with Russia. They pushed Russia away. They pushed Russia into a corner, all based on these lies that Russia somehow interfered in the election. Now there's a million Ukrainians dead because of this, and however many thousand Russian soldiers dead, the country's destroyed, all because they put Trump in a box as Putin's agent, and he couldn't do anything constructive.
So, again, my feeling is that this is all true. And I don't think we needed the information that was just dropped to know it if we were not special, right? I think everybody knew this happened.
that was willing to even entertain the idea that it happened. And I don't know that it matters that much that this data came out, because the people who didn't believe that this is what happened still don't believe this is what happened, and they will still defend the Obama-Biden administrations to their death, and Orange Man must be bad, and he's a Nazi, and he's literally Hitler, and blah, 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 blah. My view, though, is that the timing of this, and it might not even be Tulsi Gabbard did it now, but she was given clearance to do it. Like, go ahead, you can do what you wanted to do anyway, because it's convenient. So for those that don't know, there's been a lot of stink around the Epstein shit that Bondi and Cash Patel and Bongino had all promised was coming, and it's not coming, right? And, oh, we're going to go try to petition a judge to unseal a grand jury testimony, which wouldn't have told us anything, another distraction. And Trump's tried to make it like this is all a Democrat plot and all, but the people that most want this information are people that have been diehard Trump supporters. And we talked last week about how he's basically just betrayed and shit all over his most ardent supporters with all of this. Well, now there's something else to pay attention to. But the Epstein thing's not going away, guys. Thomas Massie got stuff together to force a vote on requiring the release of the Epstein files into Congress. And Congress can do this even without the president's approval. And it looked like Massie had enough momentum to get it done. So Speaker Johnson shut down Congress and went to recess early for the year. And Massey's like, I'm still coming back. And Trump's running all these campaigns against Massie. He's the worst Republican ever or whatever. And anybody that believes that is an idiot. I mean, Massie actually does the things that Republicans say they're going to do, and he actually sticks to it. And he said he's coming back with this after Congress comes back, and you can't shut me up forever. So I wonder how many versions of the talk Thomas Massie is going to get between now and when Congress comes back into session. That'll be interesting, too. But my upshot on this, and I'll put it this way. I'll make a gentleman's bet with anybody that wants to make the bet right now. I will give you $1 for every day that Barack Obama spends in jail. And if we go 1 year, okay, from the day we make the bet, you have to pay me $1 for every day Barack Obama doesn't spend in jail until he dies, right? And if somehow like 18 months, 2 years later, Obama goes into jail, I'll give you all your money back and I'll start paying you $1 for every day that he's in jail. How's that? Anybody want that bet? Yeah, because Obama's not going to jail. All these people, all these idiots, the usual surrogates, the paid shills online, justice is coming, justice is coming. No, nothing's coming. There's a bunch more bullshit. I will be shocked if even a Fall Guy or two goes down for this, if that even happens. And I don't think that it will. But it'll be an interesting distraction until, you know what we're going to get to? Another continuing resolution this fall. You just watch. We just did the big, beautiful bill. Now it's time to do cuts. Yeah, but we need to do one more CR. We have to. We have no choice. We have to. Yeah, okay, bullshit. Anyway, moving on from there, let's go ahead and talk about taxes. And that's not everybody's favorite subject, but there's no tax on overtime. I know I run my own company. I'll be a slave driver. I'll make myself work 20 hours a week overtime, and I'll pay no taxes on it. And woohoo, I win. Yeah, that's not how that works. Matt Sersley will explain why.
Hey, TSP. This is Matthew Sersley with AgoristTaxAdvice.com, here to talk about this new tax bill passed just a few weeks ago. I am getting a lot of questions about the tax-free overtime portion of it and whether it's possible for a self-employed person to take advantage of this. I totally get why it's tempting. I like where your head's at, but in this particular case, I think it's a bad idea. So, first of all, overtime only exists within an employer-employee relationship. If you are a sole proprietor or tax as one, or a partnership or tax as one, you're not an employee, you don't get wages, so you can't get overtime. Like, that's full stop, no W-2, no overtime. Now, you do have the option of either being a C-Corp or an S-Corp and being an employee. I'm not going to go into all the reasons why a C corp usually is a bad way, but suffice it to say, even if this worked with the C corp, you probably are paying so much more taxes as a C corp than you're saving with the strategy that it doesn't make any sense. So let's go with the S corp, because that's what most small business people are going to do most of the time to save money. Well, now you are an employee and you own the company that's the employer. Now, overtime already has special rules you have to follow. It has to be reported on your W-2. It has to be based on actual time records. And yes, the IRS does request those somewhat regularly. And most importantly, they have to be paid by somebody who controls the employee's hours. And yet, technically, you aren't the company. But when you run the company and make the decisions for the company, you are not different than the employee in this respect. So I think the way they're going to rule on this is to say, if you're an employee of the company you own, and if you get to determine your own schedule, you cannot take advantage of this tax-free overtime thing. Now, if you work for a company with 10 other owners and you're a minority owner, and they say, hey, you need to work these hours and we're going to pay you overtime, that might fly. That's not the situation almost anybody I know is in, but it might work. Now, here's the other thing. You're not talking about a lot of tax savings with this. First of all, the tax-free portion is only for federal income taxes. If there are, and it's only on the overtime portion, not the regular hourly portion. So let's say you're doing this to get an extra $1,000 a week in work. Well, if you're doing time and a half, only $333 of that is the tax-free overtime. You're still paying tax on the other $667. There's a really good chance that once you factor in your state income taxes, if you have any, and your FICA taxes on the whole $1,000, not the $667, that you're really not coming out very far ahead here. In addition, as an S corp owner, you're already required to pay yourself a reasonable salary. If you've been in business for a while, you've told the IRS what you believe a reasonable salary is. So the only way to do this is to add overtime onto that. Well, now again, you're paying more in FICA taxes, 15.3%. You're losing QBI on that, the qualified business income, which was 20% and is now 23% of the non-wage income you have from your business. I've run the numbers, and yeah, you come out ahead, but it's not very much. And if that's what you make for a couple years, well, this deduction goes away in a couple of years. And now maybe you have a problem where if you try to lower your salary back down to where it was before, you've made the case to the IRS, no, no, a reasonable salary is this higher number. Now, the bill specifically tells the Treasury to review situations that look like they lack a bona fide employer-employee relationship. And when they find that, to go to get back any benefits from that and to apply, well, I mean, the bill doesn't say this, but when bills say that, they're basically telling the IRS, apply the 20% accuracy penalty in addition to any other penalties and interest. So let's say you do this. Let's say you don't get away with it. Well, now you're going to owe the back payroll taxes on some section if they reclassify you, maybe. You're going to owe a 20% accuracy penalty. You're going to owe 0.5% per month in interest. And this is really easy to catch because, again, you're going to file forms to the IRS, one of which says you are the owner of the business, in many cases, the sole owner or one of two owners in a business. And then a month later, you're filing paperwork with the IRS saying, I'm an employee of this company and I got overtime because that's going to be on your W-2. So this is not like a lot of things where, okay, technically this isn't allowed, but maybe you can kind of hide it in the paperwork somewhere because it doesn't get called out specifically. But overtime gets called out specifically. So this is going to be a really, really, really easy thing for them to catch. And again, they put it in the bill. Hey, guys, look for this. And I guarantee you this is going to be a thing a lot of IRS people are going to look for because it's easy. and the IRS tends to be relatively lazy, so they go for the easy wins. This is an easy win, and if they audit you over this, they know they're going to win you on this or beat you on this. But now maybe they find some other things, and it's even a bigger deal. And let's say you win this fight. If you go through an audit because of this, you still come out behind. So I just see the cost benefit on this to be way in the negative. It is not worth playing in this game, in my opinion, for the vast majority of self-employed people. Now, if you want to maybe hire your kids and pay them overtime, that might be a better way to use this. Of course, they better be working enough hours for that to be the case. But that's a situation where I think this works much better, is when you can pay other people and do this. Maybe it's a way to pay even more tax-free to your kids. That's my favorite situation for this. What else should you do? Well, first of all, if you're in business and you haven't looked at whether an S-Corp is going to save you money, you need to look into it. Again, for the vast majority of business owners, it is the best way to run your business. It's not universal. It's actually not how I run my business because of some things going on with me and my family and my life. But for the vast majority of cases, that's going to save you money. Make sure you are loading up on all of the legit business deductions out there. Accountable plans, travel, equipment, home office, mileage. Have the company pay for as much as it possibly can legitimately. That's a guaranteed way to save money on taxes. And again, if you maybe cross the line and put in something maybe is a little bit sketchy, it kind of gets hidden in everything else. You're not waving the red flag the same way. So even if you want to be more aggressive, you're far better off doing it with the deductions than the tax-free overtime. Finally, you know, this is not the best way to do things because it defers taxes mostly, but make sure you're maxing out your retirement accounts. You know, do a Roth IRA if you can. Do a back do a regular IRA. If you're working for yourself and you don't have any employees, you can do a solo 401k and put away $70,000 a year. You can do a defined benefit plan, which is basically a pension for yourself. There's lots of ways to save a lot of money on taxes that are legitimate, that won't raise any red flags, and frankly, that will probably save you a lot more money than this anyway. Well, anyway, head over to agristtaxadvice.com/TSP. I've got a free guide with over 60 ideas for business deductions for you to consider. If you want to stop leaving money on the table without resorting to gimmicks, that's the place to start. And remember, the IRS doesn't not deserve your fear, and they don't deserve your money. You can fight back. Thanks.
Good stuff from Matt. I just want to throw this out there because as he was talking about how the overtime exemption doesn't really apply to business owners and kind of rubbing it in because you didn't think it actually applied to all your overtime, did you? Did you really? Right? See, it only applies. Let's say that your base rate, let's say you make $30 an hour and then your overtime rate would be $45 an hour. Well, if you work 10 hours of overtime, that's $450, right? But it would only be $150. That's not subject to tax. It's only the overtime portion of your total compensation, not the hours you worked in excess of 40 hours. Yeah. But what all that made me think of is like, is there a possibility that there's some accountants out there that aren't quite as good as they should be? Yeah, there is. So there is what's known is a 199A qualified business income provision. And we've had this for years. You may have been getting boned by not taking it for years if your accountant doesn't know about this. And what that is that there's a deduction of about 20% for all businesses that are passed through entities with some limitations. And this was done because there was significant cuts to corporate tax rates that since certain tax entities like LLCs have what's called pass-through income, those companies didn't get the break that the larger companies did. Because your tax rate is not set by your business, it's set by your individual income. So a person could be a owner in an LLC, a partner, a member, actually, is what you call an LLC. And, you know, on their K-1, it says you earned X amount of money. Well, there's now pass-through rates more for, like, the small person, like me, right? And I like to explain this with numbers that make sense to people. And the way this works is you have a 20% off your qualified business income. Now, you need to talk to your accountant and make sure they're doing this for you, but also make sure that you're not doing it wrong, okay? Because there are some things that are not included in that, like capital appreciation in the business itself, okay? But let's say that your business, after you paid all your expenses and you are married and filing jointly, and remember, some of your expenses are more paper than real, you know, expenses. But by the time it's all said and done with, your business income on your income statement is $110,000. Well, this qualified business income deduction is 20%, and it passes through with the income. So you and your spouse, if you married and filed jointly, would be responsible in that situation for $110,000 of income. And then you have your other deductions, the deductions everybody takes off, not the ones that are on your Schedule C, right? Okay, so that $22,000 deduction would pass through to your personal income, reducing your taxes by $22,000 and getting you down to like $92,000. What is it, $88,000? Damn, I can't do anything today. What? Okay, geez, 110 minus 20, $88,000, right? So now you're paying tax on $88,000 even though your income was $110,000. That's after all your expenses in the business. This is an additional cut. That's been in place, I think, since 2017. But when he was talking, I was thinking about that. Like, what are some of the other things in the Big Beautiful Bill that people may not be aware of? Well, this is just the Big Beautiful Bill made it permanent and increased the amount of income that can have the deduction. And so now this is like a permanent thing. And I'm just looking at this going, I guarantee there's people doing taxes for people out there that should know this, that don't. So make sure if you're running a business with pass-through income, that you're getting this QBI, or Qualified Business Income Deduction, of 20% of the amount of revenue that qualifies for it. All right, with that, let's go on and talk about Critical Load Solar.
Hey, TSP community, this is Ryan Steva with the HomesteadConsultant.com, and today I'm going to cover a topic that I threatened to cover in the last Expert Council segment that I did, and that's critical load solar systems. All right, so imagine there's some type of emergency or even just general power outage, and you're able to run all of your important systems indefinitely without any fuel or outside inputs. Now imagine that that system is somewhere under $2,000 to $3,000. Well, that's what a critical load solar system can do. Of course, it depends on what you want to run from it, but let me step you through some of the concepts and ideas on how the system is set up, and I'll talk about some of the specifics of the devices that you could use and how that would play out as well. So the first step in setting up one of these systems is determining what you actually want to run off of it. So generally speaking, you're going to run only your truly critical infrastructure. That would be things like refrigerators, freezers, well pumps, potentially lighting and internet, as well as medical equipment like oxygen devices or CPAP masks. You may also run a fan off of it, or even potentially a single room like window air conditioning unit, though I don't generally recommend it. Once you've determined the things that are absolutely critical for you to run during an outage, what you're going to do is find those circuits and break them off from your primary electrical panel into what's called the subpanel. This subpanel is then going to be run from an inverter battery backup system that can be charged from a solar array. So this system is functionally disconnected from the grid and should be able to and be sized to keep the devices that you've decided running on a consistent basis. However, most of the new inverter charge controllers also have a built-in feature so that you can plug them in as an appliance on your grid tie electrical system. And that allows you to potentially top up the batteries if you don't have enough panels to consistently top it up. So you have a fallback to that general grid system or to a generator if you need to. And then over time, as you get used to your system and how much you need, you can add batteries or add inverters as you want to grow it out. So this system both has the benefit of being able to be fairly plug and play and then bolted onto later with additional devices like batteries or additional inverter charge controllers as needed. It also ties to the grid, but not in a way that you have to deal with your permitting from your electric company, because it just plugs right into the wall like any other appliance. And it doesn't have any backfeed feature. It only runs the things on the sub panel that you've already separated from your electrical system. All right, so the next part is knowing what parts you need and how these all get sized. I have a specific recommendation for these systems, and that's an EG4 3000 watt off-grid inverter, because it has so many of the benefits that are needed to make this system work. It is a 5,000 watt input from your PV array at up to 500 volts, which gives you a lot of flexibility on what panels you use and how you set them up. And then it has a rated output of 3,000 volts for your electrical system in the house. It's bolt on, so you can put as many of these devices up to, I think, like 32 of them together. So if you want to expand your system to run your entire house, you can actually do that in the future. And right now they're on sale for $700, which is the best price I've ever seen them at. And I will leave links in the description and model numbers for Jack to put in the show notes as well. The second part of this system is a battery, also by EG4 or Signature Solar, and it's a 48-volt, 100-amp-hour battery. You can, again, bolt on, I think, up to either 16 or 32 of these onto the system. So you can add as many as you'd like. But in most cases, if you, depending on your sizing, I would start with one or two. There is some wiring and connection considerations that I've actually covered in a video that I'll also save as a link or send as a link for Jack to add, that covers wiring up one of these systems that I installed recently as an off-grid system with a generator connected. But all of the same concepts apply as far as the wiring, and rather than connecting to a generator, just consider that you're connecting it to the grid instead, which is functionally the same. This system with just one battery should cost you about $1,900 right now, not including the solar panel array. Solar panels, especially potentially used, lightly used commercial solar panels, can be extremely inexpensive. So generally speaking, your largest cost on the panels is actually going to be figuring out the mounting and where you're going to mount those. The cost is mostly going to be in the mounts themselves. So I hope those considerations help you understand what this is and what you'll need to get it up and off the ground. And you know, we see a lot online about solar generators, and honestly, that term is kind of crap because they don't generate anything. They just provide electricity until they run out of batteries. This system is truly what you could consider a solar generator. There are also a tremendous number of potential applications for this system. It's so simple and modular that you could apply it a lot of different ways, including making it fully portable, which people have done by putting it on small handcarts. So I'll include a link for that as well. Well, I hope that gets the creative juices going on how you can put in a solar backup system for your home for a tiny fraction of what going fully off-grid would be, and that it would give you some really useful redundancy for grid down, long-term outage, or even short-term outage situation. Hey, everybody, I need more questions, so get some into Jack, especially towards technical, solar, off-grid energy type stuff. I'd love to answer some of those for you. Or if you have more questions off of what I just talked about, send those into Jack. And until next time, go get your hands dirty.
So Ryan's really great about kind of going the extra mile for you guys. So He's got a whole video walkthrough on an off-grid cabin solar project, the parts, the wiring, everything that you can watch. And I mean, literally, you could watch this one short video, and if you can't pull off doing this, you probably won't ever be able to, and it's only like 12 minutes long. It's not complicated. It is kind of a bolted all together type situation. So he's got that. He's also got a link to Signature Solar that will give you $50 off your order if you use his link, and I have that in the show notes as well. And he also has two specific products from Signature Solar that he mentions in this, and it's the EG4 3K off-grid inverter and the EG4 Life Power 4 V2 lithium batteries. You can get, you know, that $50 off when buying those or anything at Signature Solar with his link. And then he has a video by someone else on building an off-grid solar cart. So that's all of those are in the show notes today directly under Ryan's bullet point. And now we're going to go on to talk about electrolytes with Andy McCann.
Hello and good morning. This is Andy McCann coming to you from Woodstock, Georgia, where I own CrossFit Garage. I've been doing CrossFit for 17 years at this point, and I've been doing health and exercise much longer than that. The real quick story is around 32, I realized I was losing a step, and I found CrossFit, and it's been awesome ever since. I do endurance racing as well, and I just use this as a super fast hack to health and fitness. Do you have to do CrossFit? No. Pick something, do something, do anything. All right, I got an email here from Mr. Sweet. He says, how much electrolytes do I need? So his bigger question is, I lost 3 pounds on a 34-minute run, given the perspiration from hot Texas temperatures. I am using Elementi. That is a very particular type of replenishment that you can buy. I got a picture here. It's got individual packets, so it's the letters L-M-N-T. I also use it. I use this raw unflavored. It is 1,000 milligrams of salt, 200 milligrams of potassium, and 60 milligrams of magnesium. So his question is, how much do I really need to be using if I lost 3 pounds in water weight? The answer is, it depends. If you're not cramping, then you're probably getting enough salt from everything else you eat, no big deal. The thing that they're saying now is, wow, you can't have too much salt. On this lion diet and carnivore diet, I am eating so much salt that I thought, surely when I go to the doctor and they do my measurements, I'm going to be in trouble. My actual salt level has dropped. So I guess your body, the ultimate adaptation machine, adapts to even this stuff, right? So anyway, I'm holding less salt even though I'm eating so much salt. So I would say do this. Go for your run and then do a packet. And do that for like a couple days in a row. How does one packet do? If you feel totally fine, then that's it. There's your answer. If you don't feel fine, if you're getting cramping, so there's no reason to supplement. If you're just like supplementing for the sake of supplementing, you may not need to. Maybe you're getting enough salt already. You're supplementing because you feel something different. You could also just try one and see how it goes. Like you're already using them. So try two and do that for a couple days. How does that feel? Try three. How does that feel? When I first started using these Element T packets, I just put it in a regular water bottle. And man, the amount of salt that I felt inside of me, it was like I had battled the waves on the coast of North Carolina for like 5 hours. I just felt beat up and super waterlogged. I did not feel good. So make sure you're drinking enough water when you use these. On the other side of it, you can go to my YouTube channel, at AndyMcCann42, type in electrolyte. You're going to see a couple things in there, how I'm making it, and some stories about how we didn't use it correctly in an adventure race. So, yeah, that's pretty funny. But the bigger one is how I'm making it. I ordered some stuff off of Amazon, and I'll put the links in there in the show for Jack to add them to his show notes. But I used this potassium chloride. There is another one you can get. It's potassium citrate. Which one do you want to use? It's a different quantity for both. Potassium citrate is what they typically tell you to use, but they say that if you're doing ketosis type stuff, that the citrate could push you out of it. I don't know if that's true, so I use potassium chloride and I just use less of it. I also use this magnesium malate, and then I used this Redmond's Real Salt. What do you need? I don't know. Experiment with this stuff. I am definitely not a doctor, but you can tell from your body like what's feeling weird. I know I'm not getting enough salt when I feel my calves or the bottom of my feet want to cramp up. I up my salt intake. Typically, I'm using about a 33-ounce glass bottle, and I pour an eighth of a teaspoon of my mixture into it. It's something like 2 cups or half a cup of salt, to 2 tablespoons of potassium and 2 tablespoons of magnesium. It's about it. I have to go find that for you, and I've adjusted it since then. Every person is different. Your body is different. You're going to have to figure out what your body really needs. I suppose the ultimate way to do it was to scrape some of your sweat, send it off, and let them analyze it. But, you know, like LMNT is making a good guess that, hey, it's about 1,000, 200, and 600 is the ratios they went with. I've adjusted mine a little bit because I do use a lot of salt on the foods that I eat, the steaks and eggs and ground beef. So I figured I could probably reduce the salt in my drink. Okay, so I would practice and test and then journal and take notes. As you guys know, the best answers are it depends, and I would try it. Everybody's body is different. So if your body is not cramping, then you're probably already okay with the amount that you're taking right now. If you feel cramps or you're not feeling like if your brain feels like it's slowing down, then yeah, maybe you need a bit more. So I would try 2 packets. I do like that they have packets because now you know how much is in them, though this is industrially made now. And so their components can be slightly off. So not every bag is actually, I would guarantee you this. There's definitely not 1,000 milligrams of sodium, 200 milligrams of potassium, and 60 milligrams of magnesium in each of these. That's what they say. They're trying to get into it, but they're allowed to be. Their tolerances are allowed to be off everybody's is. So you're not getting exactly that. So that's why I said if you make it yourself, then you kind of know. But even then, when I stir mine together, it's all mixed up, and I couldn't tell you exactly what each scoop is worth. Though I know, over time, I'm getting the right amount because my legs aren't cramping up. All right, y'all take care.
So Andy did send me links to all of the products that he uses, the 3 things that he uses, the potassium chloride, the magnesium alloy, and the Redmond salt to make his mixture. And I have those links in the show notes for you. I can just click on them. They're right under his main link. This just gave me a flashback, and it's not really important or anything. It's just an interesting, I think it's a fun memory, I guess, from my youth. When I was stationed in Honduras, I was there for 6 months. It was a pretty brutal environment. There's no, you know, lived in tents, slept on cots for 6 months, and it was hot. I mean, to give you how hot was it, right? I'm glad you asked. No, it was so hot. This is not an embellishment at all. We used to take we would eat breakfast. And at breakfast, we would grab an MRE. That was lunch, and then we would eat dinner. So you go to the field with engineers, you do fairly well. So we had 2 hot chow meals a day and 1 MRE for lunch. So those of us that worked in the camp instead of out on the road, we would generally, you know, leave wherever we worked. I worked at the motor pool, which was basically a place with a bunch of metal laid on the ground so you had something to lay on instead of dirt when you worked, so you got less ticks in your back. And with a tool van, right? So I worked there. So we'd walk back to our tent, and we had, you know, all the flaps up and all. So basically it was a shade, and we would sit in our tents on our cots and eat our MREs. So what we started doing, and it worked dramatically well, this is the days before MRE heaters. It was all the way back there in them olden days. We'd gotten rid of the C-Rats and T-Rats, but our MREs, we didn't have them fancy heater things in them. Well, what we figured out is it was so damn hot that you open the main entree, like your chili mac or your beef stew that we referred to as beef spew, or your tuna and noodles that we called 9 lives, or the corned beef hash that we called corned beef trash. We also called it Alpo Light, and it looked way too much like a can of Alpo Light dog food, whatever it was. You pull it out of the box, because it was in a box inside the big bag, and the foil package, throw it on the roof of the GP Medium tent. And you do that about, 0800, 0730, something like that, after breakfast chow. Around 1200 hours, 12 o'clock for you civilian types, take lunch, go back. Not only was it screaming hot, usually when you pulled that bag down, you could actually feel it vibrating a little bit. It was simmering. Maybe not a full rolling boil, but simmering, like almost boiling in a bag sitting on the roof of a tent. Now, what does that have to do with all this electrolyte shit? By the end of the day, everybody walking around had literal crusted salt on their back, like their shoulders and all, especially, like mechanics, we would take off the BDU top and either work in our T-shirt, those brown T-shirts, or with coveralls, depending on what we were doing. And the brown T-shirts, it would just be this giant patch over both shoulders of just like, and you literally like break it and shake salt, and you soldiers are sick in the head. So some guys are like, I'm going to put it on my food or whatever. Yeah, I guess you're recycling. But yeah, man, I mean, it really is something that can benefit you a lot, having a proper amount of sodium and other electrolytes in your body. And those of you that are going to go the route of keto or carnivore, or even a lot of you that get low carb, if not all the way to keto, one of the things that can happen is some cramping and stuff like that. And that's part of the diuretic component of the diet, especially in the beginning where you just start flushing all this fluid you're retaining that you're really not supposed to be retaining, and it takes a lot of things with it. And usually just salting your food is all you need. But in the beginning, during that transitional phase, you may find supplemental electrolytes really valuable, even if you're not doing high sweat, high endurance things. With that, let's move on. Let's talk about books with Mike Melito, specifically on hunting, guns, combat, stuff like that, and see what his recommendations are. I know at least one really lines up with mine. I might add a few more to it when after we hear what Mike has to say.
What's up, TSP? Michael here from Gunfighter Life. I thought it would be a cool segment to do some of my favorite books on guns, hunting, and gun-related topics. Hopefully you find that intriguing. First one I want to mention is the Bible. A lot of good lessons in there on warfare and use of force. I don't think the Bible needs any introduction from me. Next one I'm going to talk about, maybe you haven't heard of, The Old Man and the Boy by Robert Rourke. This is a beautifully written story of a young man getting mentored in the ways of hunting and fishing in the outdoors. It is a great story. I can't say how much it's embellished, how much of it is true, but it is a beautiful story with a lot of really good hunting, fishing, and life lessons. And it takes place in an old South that no longer really exists. The next one, a lot more recent, is American Buffalo by Steve Ranella of Meat Eater. I don't know, but I believe that he wrote this book before his show, before his podcast. And whatever you might think about his shows or his podcast or whatever, the book is a great read. It is part his hunting, like epic, of wild buffalo in Alaska, and part history lesson on the American buffalo as far as it, the animal, how it played into Native American culture and the settlement of the West. It's a beautiful story. Steve Ranella, American Buffalo. The next one on hunting, Peter Hathaway Capstick, Death in the Tall Grass. If you like stories about African safari hunting and adventure, you probably have read this book, but if that intrigues you and you haven't, Death in the Tall Grass is kind of a go-to safari African hunting adventure tome. If hunting is not really your thing, you could pick it apart if you want, but I think one of the best books written and one of the early ones in the genre of survival and preparedness, Patriots by James Wesley Rawls. It's a good fictional story, but what sets it apart from other fictional stories about the apocalypse, because those are a dime or a dozen, this one is a part fictional story and part instruction manual. So he'll mix in a little bit of story and a little bit of this is how you do this skill. So if you can't sit there and have the attention span to read an instruction manual, but you still want the information, it's really unique in that way. And I think, although it's a bit dated, it really is one of the best, like, iconic prepper survival books. And this is a survival podcast. I'm not saying I agree with everything in there, especially the gun stuff. I would probably make different choices, especially today for the guns. There's a whole chapter on the guns and their loadout and all that stuff. But it's a really good book. Another really good one, I would say gun adjacent, is Survival Theory 2. It's by Jonathan Hollerman. It is on human starvation. So realize that going into it. It is not a happy story with a happy ending. It is about human starvation in the modern world, like the 20th century, and mass human starvation. It's not a lighthearted read, and it's based on true events on, you know, what happened during collectivization in the Soviet Union and the takeover of the communists and mass starvation in China. Kind of a theme there. Communism and starvation. Talks about the starvation of the people in the Ukraine. It talks about, you wouldn't think about it, but in the Balkans in the 90s in Europe. And just some of the stories in that. If you're not serious about being able to get some of your own food, I think after you read that, it'll get a little fire lit under you. Not for everybody, not an easy read. But if you have the stomach for it, Survival Theory 2 by Jonathan Hollerman. Oh, and correction, I just saw it in my library. Death in the Long Grass. I think I said Death in the Tall Grass. Death in the Long Grass by Peter Hathaway Capstick. The next one is a Norwegian name, Vladimir Stefansson. A bunch of those strange, squiggly Norwegian letters. But it's My Life with the Eskimo. His goal is to contact, in the early 1900s, theretofore uncontacted indigenous Eskimos. He does a ton of hunting along the way. He has a ton of adventure, as you might imagine, on such an epic journey into the deep interior Arctic of, you know, Alaska and Canada. How he hunts, how the indigenous Eskimo hunt, adventure. And again, that's My Life with the Eskimo by Vladimir Stefansson. Or, I'm sorry, Villemer. Villemer Stefansson. It's a great book. I'm sure that I could go on and on about books about guns and hunting. The hard part of this segment was not getting books to put in, but just narrowing it down to some really good reads. I'm sure Jack will have some additions. I know he likes his gun books and hunting adventure stories as well. From what I've heard him talk about over the years on the podcast, just on different books that he likes. The one thing I'll close with, kind of a tactical tip, even if you don't reload, you might keep your eye open for a good reloading manual. An older one, one that's a few years old, that's cheap, even if you don't reload. Because I think just looking at it, you will glean a lot about reloading and data and different cartridges and how they stack up. So that can be a great resource. Thanks for listening. Thanks, Jack. Thanks, TSP. Have a blessed day.
Well, I do have some additions. He certainly hit on some of my favorite authors. And I have links to every book he mentioned, plus every book I'm going to mention in the show notes underneath his bullet point. Number one, I highly endorse Mike's endorsement of Robert Rorick's Old Man and the Boy. That is a fantastic read. And it is the Old South that doesn't exist anymore. And it's very much the Old South that doesn't exist anymore, because it tells the story of Robert's time being raised and mentored by his grandfather. And when I say doesn't exist anymore and how old the Old South is, Rourke died in 1965. Now, he was only 49 years old. The man drank like a fish and blew up his liver by the age of 49. And that said, the man was an incredibly prolific writer to have done as much as he did by the age of 49. When I think about how much work got done by 49, I kind of feel like maybe I'm not getting enough done. I definitely recommend that you check out everything this guy wrote about Africa. But he was born in 1915. So the Old Man and the Boy takes him up into his teens. So you're talking pre-1930 is the story setting of this. And so it's a really great book in a lot of ways. Moving on, Use Enough Gun. If you can find a copy that's not ridiculously expensive, because it's one of Rourke's books that doesn't seem to be back in print anew, And it actually has, it's a pieced together book that has some unique stories about Africa and his safaris there, and also pulls in some pieces of other works, like The Old Man and the Boy. And there is a story about how he got his first shotgun from his grandfather at the beginning of Using Enough Gun. It's probably the best-known classic work by Rourke on hunting in Africa. Then there's also Horn of the Hunter by Rourke. I really recommend that one as well. And there's some pieces of Horn of the Hunter pulled into Use Enough Gun as well. When he mentioned Peter Capstick's Death in the Long Grass, everything by Peter Capstick as well. I am a huge fan of Capstick. I have multiple first editions of Capstick's work. Death in the Long Grass, Death in the Lonely Land is another really great one. I first learned how to make biltong from Peter Capstick. And I believe it was Death in the Lonely Land is the book that that's in. One of the Death in books is actually like a whole bunch of short stories, many of them from his time as a columnist at Sports Field. And the one on making biltong is one of those. Patriots Coming Collapse was one of the first books I read when I really got into this space to understand it better. It was good. It's one of those things, it's like, how can I describe this without sounding like I'm being insulting, because I'm not. It's like the bad movie that you want to watch anyway. You know it's bad, but you like it. You know? And I don't mean like a stupid one like Airplane or something like that. I mean, there's some stuff in it, it's like, eh, whatever. But, I mean, I read it twice, cover to cover. Now, the technical manual components in it, there are some where you say, okay, I'm going to just skip over that because no one talks that way. I see what you're trying to do, James. I get it. I think the overall theory of how society breaks down in it is preposterous. I just don't think life works that way. But you're writing prepper porn, so I'll let it be what it is. I think it's a very good read. I think you would enjoy reading it. I will say this about Rawls. I do not feel about Rawls like I do like Capstick or Rourke or anything like that. Like everything Rawls, no. Like, I've tried to read some of his other books. I really didn't get anything out of them. I just didn't. And he comes off a little holier than thou and such in all his books. And Patriots, it's just a little bit easier to take it, I guess. Maybe because you hadn't read anything by him yet. It doesn't continuously get done. The book he mentioned by Vladimir Stefanson, The Life of the Eskimos, I've never read that. I might pick that up. Here's a couple more I have for you to consider. One is by John Henry Patterson, and it is The Man-Eaters of Tsavo. And if you're like, that sounds familiar, if you're thinking of The Ghost in the Darkness, the Val Kilmer movie, yeah, this is the real story that that movie is based on. And you also find in some of Capstick's books retellings of that story as well that are pretty fascinating. And then two by Teddy Roosevelt, Theodore Roosevelt, former president of the United States, the Rough Riders, that guy. He was a real deal, man. Hunting Trips of a Ranchman takes place in the United States. Really amazing. And then African Game Trails. He's got a bunch of great books. Some on stuff like this, adventure and hunting, and some on other things. And they're all good. But those two are my favorite out of Teddy Roosevelt. And I will tell you that Rourke and Capstick both had kind of special places in their hearts for Roosevelt. One thing you'll notice about the people that I'm mentioning, Rourke, Patterson, Roosevelt, Capstick, they're all gone, long gone. They all write of a time that I never really knew, but I grew up reading the works of these people, and I think it shaped a lot of my view of the world and my love of the outdoors and hunting and guns. So I'm happy to get an opportunity here, thanks to Mike, to share that with you yet again. Next up, before we have my segment, let's go on and hear from Carrie Brown on foraging a plant called primrose.
Hey, TSP community. Carrie here from Strong Roots Resources, and today I want to tell you guys a little bit about evening primrose. So evening primrose is a biennial plant that's pretty common throughout much of the U.S., good part of Canada, is actually native here and has been introduced over in Europe. It grows really well in poor soils as long as they're well drained and that it's getting, 6 to 8 hours of sun. It's known for how its flowers open up in the evening and then close up again when the sun comes back up in the morning. So all parts of evening primrose are edible, but there's a few things you kind of need to know first before you start working with it. So since it's a biennial, it spends its first year as that very compact and flat rosette pressed against the ground. But that's when you actually want to be harvesting the root, because once it's in its following stage in the second year where it begins to put up a shoot, that root becomes very fibrous and it's not really worth dealing with at that point. So harvesting the root in that first year, you can do that pretty much fall through spring. If you can dig it, you can get to that root and just prepare it like you would any root vegetable. A lot of folks say that they are similar to parsnip. When I've had them, it actually kind of reminds me of salsify. So they're really good if you roast them up with some other root vegetables. And in terms of taste and texture, I'd say it's roasted really the way to go. You could certainly chop them up, do them in a stew or something like that. I thought the flavor was really brought out when you throw it in a roasting pan. So once it enters its second year of growth, it's going to start putting up that primary stalk. That's when you can start harvesting the leaves as well as the shoots, but both of those are much better if you cook them very lightly. The plant, those shoots and those leaves can have a real, just not a pleasant mouthfeel, for lack of a better descriptor at the moment. You really want to put them through a bit of a cooking process. But when you get to the flower buds and the flowers themselves, you can eat those raw and fresh. They're kind of peppery. The flowers have a scent that kind of reminds me of lemons and honey. Those are very good, and I will clip those off and we'll add those to whatever other fresh greens we're having at that part of the year, along with our salads, and you can dress them. You can use it as a garnish. They're super pretty and kind of unusual, kind of a neat thing to add to those kind of dishes. Primrose can also set a pretty significant amount of seed, and I've noticed that if you coppice off that main stalk, it will make multiple like secondary stalks, so you can actually wind up with one plant producing quite a bit of seed, and those seeds can be used in breads or cereals. And it looks like the seeds contain some omega-6 fatty acids, which is in the plant world rather uncommon. So that's a potential source for those kind of fatty acids when you're foraging fresh foods. In doing my research on this plant, I wanted to read up and learn a little bit more about the medicinal side. There are essential oils made from the seeds that have been studied in terms of addressing poor circulation and various inflammatory related ailments. So if those are things that you're dealing with, you might want to take a look at quality essential oils made from evening primrose seed. There's some cautions. There are some cautions, especially if you're going to interact with an essential oil, but even for you know, regular consumption of this plant. Parts of the plant can contain compounds that can interact with phenothiazine drugs. So those are actually like your older antipsychotic drugs like Thorazine. So you need to know that. The seeds also can act as a blood thinner. So if that's already an issue with your health, pay attention to that. If you want to read up more on quite a bit of detail for that plant, a lot of the data I was able to gather came from plantsforafuture.org and also Samuel Thayer's Field Guide to Wild Edible Plants, which I have told folks more than one time. If you just want one book for foraging, that's the book that I steer people towards. So take a look around your land, see if you can find just some evening primrose. Pretty good plant, pretty good chance you've already got that plant hanging around. Mine comes up all around the pastures. I let it come up in my pollinator gardens. I don't let too many plants come up because of the amount of seed. It can spread pretty vigorously, but I'll keep a few. Of course, it's one of those great pollinator-supportive plants, so that's one of the reasons alone, plus, you know, being able to take 10 steps out my front door and have something to harvest from. So thank you for listening, and we will talk to you guys next time.
All right, great stuff from Kerry Brown. Let's go ahead and do my segment for the day. Nathaniel sent me an email, and he did it the right way. He put TSPC in the subject line, and that way I know it's for me, and I know it's related to the show. And that's what you should do. If you want to hear anything that you send me on the air, it's much more likely to happen if you follow that procedure, TSPC in the subject line. Message is, how do I build a website similar to yours, but as a retail site for my tree nursery, some blogging, and to compile customer contact info? Thanks for the influence from you, David the Good, Mark Shepard, Akiva Silver, and a few others. I decided to take a plunge and start selling my tree seedlings that I've been growing for a few years. I just had my first sale on Etsy. They took $4.80 for in fees on a $4.99 hackberry seedling. Obviously, that's no way to run a business. My wife sells her authored book through a Wix website, but I'm not convinced that's the best way to do things. Any additional advice would be greatly appreciated. Thanks, Nathaniel. Nathaniel, let's talk about a couple things. Let's just start off with how do you fix your problem with Etsy? Because you might still want to use Etsy in spite of the help I'm about to give you, at least as a lead generation tool, right? So if you can, you know, make 19 cents to get a lead versus pay to get a lead, that's pretty good. But how do we fix the Etsy thing? So I have never sold on Etsy, but based on my knowledge of other sites like it, and having bought things from Etsy, and looking at the way a lot of sellers are doing business on Etsy, I think you're running into what we would call a minimum fee and then a percentage fee. Because I bet you if you sold a $49 hackberry tree set, you know, set of trees or whatever, they wouldn't have been $48 in fees. So one of the things that you can do if you want to be able to price something that low, like $4.80 for a single tree seedling, is, you know, sell four for $20. Well, somebody might not want four, then they don't need to buy from you so that you can lose money on Etsy. So if I was selling on Etsy, I would either do groupings or parts or just raise my price, do whatever I needed to make it worth selling there. And the reason you're going to sell on Etsy is mainly so that you can move that customer into your database. So before I give you the website information that you asked for, let me give you a basic sales principle. And you can use this sales principle in web marketing. And that is that in sales, you have to go into the cold market, right? Like, it'd be great if you could always get referrals from the customers you already have, but eventually you bring that out. And you need to bring in new people into your funnel. And so that's called cold calling. That's picking up the phone, that's knocking on doors, that's sending out emails, that's whatever it is you do, you know, doing lead generation at a trade show. It's whatever you do to get new people into your funnel, right, your sales process funnel, that you didn't know and they don't know you, and that's like your first contact with them. Well, there's a saying in sales, the only reason you go to the cold market is to get into somebody else's warm market. In other words, it takes so much effort to convert somebody from a cold call into a sale that if that's all you get out of it, you're basically on a treadmill, you're not getting anywhere. But if every time we bring somebody in from cold calling, whether we get a sale or not, we get two or three referrals off them, then we can infinitely cold call. So sites that you sell on, like Etsy or eBay or any Facebook Marketplace, any of this stuff, if you're actually in business, you're not just one-off dumping some shit, you need to see it that way. Like, I'm getting into somebody else's warm market, but in this case, Etsy is the cold call, and every customer is a new warm market prospect. You've done business with them now. Now they're your warm market. They're much easier to do business with a second time. So you need to be moving people into your regular marketing processing funnel when you get them off of a place like eBay, right? They get subscribed to your newsletter whether they wanted to or not, however you want to handle it, okay? Or it's not worth doing at all. Now, how do we build a website, and what do we build a website with? I agree, I would not use Wix. I would not use the GoDaddy Builder or any of these site builders. A number of years ago, when I built the site for our little farm business, nonmile.farm, I used GoDaddy's site builder against my own better inclination, and assuming that the only reason that it wouldn't matter to me is we weren't not going to do any e-commerce or anything like that anyway. We should basically a brochure website, how to contact us and how to do business with us. And so I built it. And then I started to do all my things that I know how to do with the site so that, like, if somebody searches for Dallas duck eggs or Fort Worth duck eggs, they will find us on Google, number one. And I found out I couldn't do them. Because I did not have the ability to change things like title and description tags. And the price that GoDaddy gave me for the site builder site was, like, you know, pretty decent, but it was like another $4 just to be able to, like, do my own title and description tags. So I said, screw it, I'm doing this to find something easy for my people to use, I'll do it. And so I gave them the $4, and then they wouldn't let me do it my way. They wanted to tell me how to do it. They gave me a tool to help me do it, which would be fine if I could turn it off. And they'd, no, you don't want to do this. Yes, I do. I'm better than you at this. I've been doing this before your company existed, before you made a deal with Danica Patrick for a Super Bowl commercial. I was doing this. I do not need your help. And it was locked down. And I ended up moving it to, dun-dun-dun, WordPress. And my site and all the sites that I own and manage and run right now are built on, dun-dun-dun, WordPress. The Survival Podcast is built on WordPress. JacksLaws.com is built on WordPress. Yeah? Okay. Home Food Systems is built on, dun-dun-dun, WordPress. So what do you think I'm going to tell you to use? Yes, WordPress. Now, WordPress came out originally, it was a blogging platform. It has turned into probably the number one used website building platform on planet Earth. Now, if you are a large, large company and you're going to do a bunch of custom work and all, and you might want to use some special programming languages, and okay, you get a pass. You wouldn't be asking me this question if that was you, though, so you're not. If you are a small business person and you use anything other than WordPress to build your website, you are wrong. I'm sorry. I hate saying that. I hate people like, you can carry any gun you want, but if it's not a Glock 19, you're wrong. Shut up. Go away. I don't want to talk to you. Okay? And so I hate saying it, but when I look at the totality of the reality, you're wrong. And this is why you're wrong. No matter where you get your hosting from, you can probably reach out to who you buy your hosting from, and they probably have a free service to install WordPress for you on your domain. Okay? So, like, everybody has it. And if they don't, it's really easy to do. And if you don't have, like, a button you can push to get it done with your web hosting that you buy, whoever you buy it from, somebody can do it for you for less than $50 and get it basically set up for you. Okay, your web host will probably do it for free, and if you pick one that says they'll do it for free, then you'll know you get that out of the gate. So setting it up is easy, logging in is easy. Anything you want to know how to do in WordPress, you go to YouTube and say, how do I blah 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 in WordPress, and it will tell you. Anything you want your website to do within reason, you know, if you want to build the next great Netflix-style streaming platform, it's probably not going to be there. But, like, normal shit that any normal person wants to do, there is something called a plugin that does it. You want to put a directory on a site? There are many plugins that make directories on your website. You want to put in a way to catalog product and do e-commerce, which you would want to do? Hey, WooCommerce plugin and done. And there's other options for that. You want to be able to do what I said about doing title and description tags for your pages, and you should. All-in-one SEO plugin and done. And it is literally you click a button and turn it on. Hit activate, and there it is. Okay? Whatever you want to do. For instance, I don't get anywhere near as many comments as we used to because all the discussions on social media now. But when people do make comments, if they get an answer, I would like them to know whether it's from me or somebody else. So I wanted a thing like if you put a comment on the blog and then somebody followed up on the comment, then you would get an email saying, hey, so-and-so responded to your comment. Free plugin. Click a button. Turn on activate. Done. You see what I'm saying? Now, one recommendation I have for most people using WordPress that some people will not agree with is, they changed to what's called a block editor, which lets you do some really fancy shit. But I hate it. Doing all my updates and everything with it sucks, maybe because I learned without it. But there is an editor, there is a plugin called Classic Editor. Click a button, hit activate, done. Right? Anything you want to do that you do not know how to do, there are a bazillion people who can work with WordPress. WordPress is built on PHP, and MySQL. That's the engine that is WordPress. There isn't a programmer out there worth their salt that doesn't know how to do basic PHP programming work. That's why there's so many plugins, because if you know PHP, you can build plugins for WordPress. Okay? anything you want to do at the level you're talking about, you can do with WordPress. And so that's what I would do. But here's my other advice. When people go to build a website who never built one before, they get all hung up on appearances and looks and everything like that. That is something to pay somebody to do. You know, we did a show yesterday on publishing a book with KDP, and we said, like, your typesetting and all, just hire the guy that we had on here to do it. It's going to cost you about $300, and it's worth it because he'll do it right, and he'll do it quick, and it'll be done. So what you should do when you build a website is you should figure out what you want the flow to look like. I'm talking about take a notebook and a home page and what your sub pages are and then what your sub pages are and what the and then develop the content for them and just make the site and then pay somebody to make it look good. Design a logo, do a masthead, whatever it is, and make the appearance good. You focus on the content because you know the content and they don't. And you can have that going simultaneously. Once you get enough of a framework up that they know what they're working with, they can build you and just get somebody to do it. Get somebody to do the artsy-fartsy part of it, and this is why. Again, same thing I said yesterday. If I was going to be writing books every day for the rest of my life, if that was going to be my life, I get up and I write books for 4 to 6 hours and do their marketing for another hour or two, and then I go on with the rest of my day, and that's my job. I would probably learn to do typesetting because that would be my I would do it a lot. And I would probably learn how to design book covers because I would do it a lot. Right? I'd be putting out 5 books a year. I would probably be worth knowing how to do it. I would not only develop the skill, I would have enough effort in it, I would get good at it, and I would get the muscle memory because I would be doing it frequently. Yeah? So I would probably do that if I was going to be a full-time independent author. But I'm not. I'm going to write maybe a book every year or two. So I'm going to pay somebody to make my jackets. I'm going to pay somebody to do my typesetting, right? I'm going to use somebody to do some basic editing and stuff like that for me. I'm not going to do that. Conversely, I do my own audio editing because I put out a show a day. And when you do something every day, you get good at it and you get quick at it. And when I get people all the time, I could do your editing for you and save you so much time. No, you can't. Stop saying stupid things you don't know anything about. What do you mean? Why is it stupid? Because it would take me longer to give you the files and tell you what I wanted done than to just do it. It literally takes me actual work. Now, there's some things the computer has to do that I have to wait on. That would be true no matter who did it. From the time that I say, and I'll catch you tomorrow with another one, or helping you live a better life, if times get tougher, whatever I close with, from that moment, unless I want lunch or something, till I go render MP3, click, upload, less than 5 minutes. So I'll do that. If I was going to produce one audio thing a year, I would pay somebody to do it. So since you're not going to go into graphics design, don't learn graphics design. You're not going to do enough of it to make it worth your time. That's what I'm going to say is that's why WordPress... Lay out the basic framework of the site, develop the content, but what you should learn how to do yourself, and again, you can find out how to do it using YouTube, is how to add a page, how to do a blog post, how to insert an image and make it look right, how to resize it, all of that stuff, because you're going to do this a lot. And that's the other reason I love WordPress. When you log into the back end of your WordPress site, you can edit posts, you can add posts, you can edit pages, you can add pages. You can change what's called the slug, which is like today's episode is thesurvivalpodcast.com/experts-3710, right? You, like all of that, you can set up the appearance. It's a control panel. It's beautifully laid out. Now, I know that I think it's easier than it is, or it's more intuitive than it is, because I started using WordPress in 2005. Okay? So, when you've been using something for 20 years, you don't even have to think anymore. But it is really the best platform for the most people, because you can do a lot of things for yourself, and whatever you can't do, there is no shortage of people who can. And again, when you say, well, I wish my site could do this, check the plugins. It's either going to be a free plugin that might have some, you know, advertising or something built into it that you don't care for. They'll have a premium version thereof where you can give the person a few bucks and then you know, you have it. Or it's going to be like a really high-end solution. Like if you go to homefoodsystems.com, where I sell my online courses on, you know, bioreactor compost, cover cropping, stuff like that, that's all built on a platform called LearnDash, which is just a set of WordPress plugins. So the exams, the keeping score, the profiles, all of that is built in because people make things to plug into WordPress. And yeah, I said big sites maybe have the University of Florida uses LearnDash and WordPress for their online learning platform. Right? So this is accessible to anybody, open source, everybody can do it, and powerful enough for major universities to use, so it's definitely powerful enough for a guy selling some tree seedlings. And then I would also say learn a little bit about marketing. Because the one thing you get out of Etsy that you will not get out of your site is that people will see your product because you're listed there. You're going to have to learn how to drive traffic to go along with the rest of this. But I would definitely do that and maybe keep selling on Etsy and other third-party platforms. Just migrate those customers into a place that you can take care of them and nurture them and cultivate them like you do your trees. Take care of your customers. What you want to be is you want to be a farmer, not a miner. That means you want to take care of your customers so much they want to do business with you and they want to refer business to you versus a miner who's simply extracting as much as they can as fast as possible. With that, let's go ahead and wrap up. I do have a couple things I wanted to say today at the end of an episode that is, this was a rough week for Gen X, man. Guys, gals, we lost some people this week that were, you know, if you grew up in the 80s, the three names that are no longer with us from this week, man, start out with somebody that was young when we were young, if you're Gen X, right? Theo Huxtable, Malcolm Jamar Warner. He was the first person to check out quite prematurely, I might add, this week. He was on vacation with his daughter swimming, got caught in some sort of rip current or something like that, and she was saved and he died, so his daughter watched her father die. Theo Huxtable, the inventor of the bacon burger dog, also was on some other really interesting, like, I thought he did some pretty good work as an adult actor, too. He was on a show called, a hospital show called The Resident, where he played this, started out a very arrogant surgeon. It turned out he wasn't really arrogant. He was just really good. He was good in that show, and he was good in some other things. He was a good dude overall, man. So we lost Theo Huxtable. Then Ozzy freaking Osbourne. Now, maybe not a huge surprise to anybody that that was coming, maybe a little bit faster than expected, but Ozzy? You grew up in the 70s and 80s? Ozzy? Yeah. This is one I think that hits people because we lost a lot of people, I think, our generation did, Gen X, right, over the years. But they were, like, much older than us. You know, we're starting to see people go now, like Malcolm was our age, right? Right in, Malcolm was Gen Xer himself. Ozzy was kind of a younger boomer, I guess. But, you know, 70, something like that, you know, like, oh, man. Like, yeah, we're starting to, like, it's the whole effect of, like, when you walk through a graveyard, the birth dates start getting closer to yours, you know. And, yeah, Ozzy lived an interesting life, but losing him kind of sucked. And then today, just before I started the show, the news came out. Hulk Hogan. Hulk Hogan died, I think, heart attack, I think, is the cause. Age 71. That's not that far away for many of us. But, I mean, come on, guys. Right? Train, say your prayers, and eat your vitamins, right? I mean, like, we grew up with this guy. He was larger than life. I mean, we all knew wrestling was fake, right? But there was just a part of Hogan that was just legitimate. He was a really interesting guy. Again, larger than life. And it seemed like he really tried to be a positive role model for people, to me, even though he was in kind of a goofy pseudo-sport. He was an incredible athlete. Huge man. But I think he probably lived most of his life on steroids, and that's probably had a lot to do with him checking out a bit younger than we would have all hoped. But I just wanted to kind of acknowledge that we lost three, you know, 80s icons, I would say, in Malcolm Jamal Warner, Ozzy Osbourne, and Hulk Hogan. And for those of you way older than us and all, that, man, I knew Ozzy when it was Black Sabbath in 90. Yeah, we did too. Trust me, we were all rolling around in 70s cars in the mid-80s listening to tapes from like 1968. We really were, you know, like new music for us was like Meatloaf from 78, and this is like 86. Right. We were a generation that really did kind of grab on to the things before us and the things that were around us at the same time. And those three guys were really part of it. Really part of it. And, man, rest in peace, Theo Huxtable, inventor of the bacon burger dog. Hulk Hogan, I'll keep saying my prayers and eating my vitamins for you, brother. And Ozzy, you know, I hate to say it, the war pigs are still here. But we will not forget your rallying cry. With that, I hope you guys enjoyed today's show. And I do have one more thing I want to throw out there. The guy I had on yesterday, the libertarian book designer, has had already two people from this audience reach out to him about a book and doing the work for their books. So I think that's great. I wasn't probably the most attended live stream of the year, probably the least. I knew that would happen, but he was so helpful to me, I wanted to give him the platform to be able to let you guys know what he did. But he said, you know, obviously for those that listened yesterday, he's Polish. And, you know, it's kind of hard when English isn't your first language and you're on a live stream and you think it's like the whole world looking at you. So he has that language barrier, and he does very good work for the art design and all, but he's not an editor. All the editors he knows are around him, so they're all Polish. So you really don't want a person whose native language is Polish editing a book in English. So he's looking for editors that he can refer business to. So if you are an editor and you like to do editing work, you could just email him and let him know how you know about him, and just email hello@thelibertarianbookdesigner.com. hello@thelibertarianbookdesigner.com, and just put editor, I guess, in the survival podcast editor, something like that, so he knows where your email's coming from. And just tell him, hey, if you have someone that needs editing work, here's how to get in touch with me. And I'll leave it at that. With that, again, one more reminder, MSB is on sale. Discount code SUMMER. Get it for $35 a year, and does apply to renewals. Do your online shopping at T-Spaz. Have a great weekend. I'll catch you again next week.
Said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.